Kanga Audio.
A quick thanks before we start the show. Filmmaking Confidential, the book, is getting rave reviews from readers, filmmakers, film professors, and even people in creative fields other than filmmaking. I just want to say thank you to all of you who ordered it and for your support. If you haven't yet picked it up and you want to learn more filmmaking secrets, Filmmaking Confidential is for you. It's available wherever books are sold in most countries around the world. Order it by visiting Audible or Amazon. To find out more, check out filmmakingconfidential.com and stevebalderson.com, and thank you. I'm Steve Balderson, and you're listening to the Filmmaking Confidential podcast. Each week, we meet with filmmakers, writers, actors, artists, and other notables. Many episodes include questions or commentary from other filmmakers listening to the conversation. Today's guest is Academy Award nominee and Golden Globe winning actress, Sally Kirkland.
Oliver Stone began coming to my parties, so I got to know him socially. And then when he did Midnight Express, he either won an Oscar or got an Oscar nomination for his screenplay. And I taught acting starting in the early 70s, middle 70s, for 30 years. So back then, I would have classes. I had a loft where I taught students. And Oliver gave these great, great talks, and he loved it. It was something he loved to do. And Q&As with my students, and he came frequently. And then jump cut over the years, like I said, we knew each other socially. When it came time for me being nominated for the Oscar and winning the Golden Globe, he congratulated me. He was very proud of me. He was kind of blown away. And then I don't remember the year of JFK. What was it, 1991?
Around.
Oh, let's say it was 91. When the press started coming out about him making this film, and Kevin Costner and Sissy Spacek and all of these wonderful actors. I was at William Morris at the time. There were a lot of William Morris people in it. I called him up and I said, Oliver, my mother was best friends with Jackie Onassis, Jackie Kennedy, and Shelley Winters, my godmother and mentor, worked for John Kennedy. And I grew up hearing all these stories and feeling like I knew them. I have to be in this film. And he said, I'm so sorry, Sally. It's cast. It's fully cast. There's no roles. I think you're brilliant. I saw Anna. I think you're brilliant, but there's nothing. And I said, write something. He said, no, I can't do that. And I said, Oliver, you don't understand. My mother put Jackie Kennedy on the cover of Life magazine over and over. So finally he said, let me think about this. He called back a couple days later and he said, Sally, I've been thinking about this. There were three women who were assassinated for knowing too much about the coming assassination of Kennedy. One was Dorothy Kilgallen, the journalist. One was, I can't remember the name, a Chicago doctor. And one was Rose Shirami, who worked for Jack Ruby. Would you be willing to come to my office and audition for me, improvising all three women? And I will tell you a little bit about each one. So I wore, a G-string and tassels, because Rose Shirami was a stripper, among other things, underneath a skirt and blouse, underneath a doctor's-like jacket. And I showed up at his office, and I began with the doctor, and then I went to Dorothy Kilgallen. And when I got to Rose Shirami, and he told me that she was on drug withdrawal and all of this, and I mean, I know that. I was pronounced dead from drugs back in the day when I was a kid. Don't do them now. So I took off my clothes, and there I was. At the time, I had 38 double D breasts, this G-string, and he was completely shocked. And I started improvising, and the screams started streaming down my face. And I'm talking about Kennedy's going to be assassinated on one. And after it was over, he said, how did you do that? I've never seen anything like that. And I said, well, I've been acting since I was 17 and I'm a method actor and I studied with Strasberg since 62. And he said, but I've never seen anybody that quickly go into a nervous breakdown kind of thing. And I said, well, thank you. And he said, I can't remember whether he hired me on the spot or whether he called me the next day, but he pretty much said, I want you to be Rose Shirami. And he said, Sally, I've had death threats by my doing this movie. So I want you to be in the movie. I can't give you star billing. You're going to be one of the many, many, many star cameos that will be listed at the end. There were so many people like Jack Lemmon, people from William Morris that did cameos. You're going to be one of them. He said, you must not talk about this film. You must not talk about anything that you and I talk about. And you will have your scene being thrown out of the car. I don't know if you all remember the opening of JFK. I get thrown out of the car. You fucking asshole. And I wanted to fall out of the car myself. And he said, you're crazy. I have a stunt woman. I said, no, I'm a method actor. So they did a long shot with the stunt woman. And then the close-up, there was blood coming down my leg. And Oliver was so shocked. Oliver and I discussed how I worked. He wanted to know how I worked. And I said, I like to do things on the first take because I'm a theater performer and the crew and you guys are my audience. So I want to shock you and surprise you. If we do it twice, it's boring to me because I've already done the main thing. So unless you want to shoot it, again, which of course you may, I'd like to shoot the rehearsal is what I said. So he told his crew to be prepared for that. And we did the scene. And then some time passed before the next scene. I can't remember whether I came back to LA and then they flew me back there. This time we went to a club in Texas and I said, well, Oliver, do you mind if I strip? You know, I mean, I know that's not in the movie, but while we're sitting here with you and Kevin and me, do you mind if I go up and talk to the strippers and ask if I can come out and strip with them? And he said, no. And of course I had these 38 double D breaths. And I went up backstage with the strippers. I asked them if it'd be okay. They said, well, sorry, Miss Kirkland, but we're all union and you're not a union member. And I said, oh, that's so disappointing. I really wanted to impress Oliver and Kevin with my ability to strip. Because I'd play the stripper in High Stakes. When I was a kid, I was a stripper in The Sting. You know, I had had my share of strippers. So that didn't happen. But I sat at the table with Oliver and Kevin. Oh, I knew Kevin from when he was a stage manager at the Raleigh Studios. So I really knew Kevin. And all the strippers came over with their tits hanging over. And we're sitting at the table and I'm thinking, oh my God, I feel guilty. I'm sitting here like a fly on the wall with all these women with tits hanging in the faces of Oliver and Kevin. They loved it. They just kept bringing in the drinks, schmoozing and having a great old time. That was a method acting exercise for me. They were nice enough to let me do that because I work that way.
Yeah.
And then when we got to the hospital, Oliver said, Sally, how would you like to do this? I was always amazed that he would ask me. And I said, I'd like you to shoot the rehearsal. And I would love it if you could get the crew to wheel the gurney down the hall of the hospital and let me be screaming on the gurney or whatever's going on with me before we go into the room. And then he said, okay, in the room, there will be press and there will be doctors. And I said, okay. And he said, I'm going to shoot this in 8mm, 16, 35, black and white and color. I said, great, let's do it in one take. Let's shoot the rehearsal. He said, you sure? You don't want to rehearse? I said, no. And so they put me on the gurney. They rolled me down the hall. I'm screaming my head off. If you saw the film, you remember that I'm put on the bed. I'm screaming, they're going to kill the president, whatever my lines were. And tears. It was like a psychotic moment for me as an actor. It was like one of those moments where I didn't know what was going to come out of me. I just believed that Kennedy was going to die. And so it was very powerful. I remember when I saw the film at the Academy, you could hear a pin drop when that scene happened, because you just seen Jackie Kennedy come off the plane and whatnot, and Jack, and then suddenly they flashed to me in the hospital, screaming and yelling and crying. After it was over, Oliver said, "Wow." You know, he said, "I can't believe you did that." And he said, "I'm happy. Are you happy?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm happy if you're happy." And so that was that. And they came out with a book called Stone. And there's at least two or three pages about this in it.
But you guys didn't do a second take? You just used the rehearsal?
Yeah.
Cool. That's so good. Okay, in the middle of that story, you said that you were pronounced dead. And weren't you pronounced dead in the past at least twice?
I was in three comas, but I was only pronounced dead. My heart stopped, my lungs stopped in 1966. I think I was 23 or something, when I had tried to kill myself with 50 codeine and 50 Nebutal, and sat on the 13th story edge of my mother's building waiting to get stone enough to fall, because I was in love with Rip Torn, who never told me that he wasn't legally separated from Geraldine, which I thought. Meanwhile, she's given birth to twins, which I didn't know about. Oh, my God. And I had already been in Payne Whitney for a while in New York. I looked on my files in the office when they weren't around, and it said Sally Kirkland, schizophrenic. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. I'm schizophrenic. I didn't see it, but that's the way they described me. And I got an outpass from Payne Whitney because I belonged to the suicide club, which a bunch of us met for breakfast every morning and described how we were going to kill ourselves. And one person was going to do rat poison, and one person was going to do hang themselves, and one person was going to jump off the building, and one person was going to overdose. And we would all meet in the morning and have these wonderful meetings where only us could laugh about it. We had a sense of humor about how we were all going to do this and who was going to be the first to do it. And I decided I would be the first to do it. And they all applauded. There was a filmmaker there, Willard Maass, M-A-A-S-S, very famous underground filmmaker in the 60s in New York. Willard Maass, one of the Andy Warhol, you know, one of that crowd. So I got an outpass and went to my mother's apartment. She was leaving for Europe for 2 or 3 months. She had a bottle to last her through the summer. I went to her bathroom. I did the whole bottle. I looked in the mirror. I thought, wow, I'm free. And then I went out, went up to the 13th story, sat on the ledge, waited to fall. I wasn't getting stoned fast enough before a Czechoslovakian manager of the building saw the open window, which wasn't supposed to be open because the people were gone for the summer, and stuck out his head and said, "Miss Kirkland." And suddenly my bubble burst. I had been in this psychotic bubble. I was not in my right mind. And I looked at him and I thought, oh my God, he's got 5 children and a wife. Do I have the guts to jump? And I still wasn't stoned. The pill still hadn't really taken effect. In that moment, my compassion for him, because he was in complete shock, I didn't want to ruin his life. I allowed him to pull me in. I ran past him out into the street, hid in the Guggenheim bushes, saw everybody running around the building looking for me. And then I remembered that my girlfriend Sandy lived a couple blocks down on Fifth Avenue. And there was a back alley that we used to hang out in that had a bunch of garbage. And that I would get to there and I would get down on the ground behind the garbage disposals and hide and die. So I didn't get that far. I passed out in front of Jackie Kennedy's building. I think it's 1040 Fifth Avenue. And I remember the doorman by the building laughing and talking and laughing. And I remember I was in my best dress. I had a silver armband. I'd written a suicide note to Rip, but without signing Sally Kirkland. And no ID. I went unconscious. I went out. And so the story goes, two gentlemen. Am I boring you?
No, this is fascinating.
Oh, okay. Two gentlemen from the ship were on their one-day pass, and they were going to the Guggenheim, and one was the ship's doctor, and one was the ship's priest. And so they saw this woman on the ground, completely out, and they stopped, and the ship's doctor, my heart had stopped, my lung had stopped, he pronounced me dead. The ship's priest did Catholic rites over me. And then they decided in the 11th hour that they would go to Harlem. And so they got me to the Metropolitan Hospital, and I was still out. And then I guess they put me on a machine they had never used before. I was like a newbie trying out this machine. I assumed that at some point I was breathing, but I was in a coma. You know, I was gone. I was a vegetable, so they said. One of my best friends in the world, Betty Bennett, had a dream that her friend Sally was dying or dead. And she was best friends for Andre Gregory, my dinner with Andre, who was my director at the Theater of Living Arts in Philadelphia. She called him and said, I just dreamt that Sally died. And he said, I don't know, but I heard that she had a nervous breakdown. So she intuitively thought that I tried to kill myself. And so she went to every hospital in New York trying to find me. And she finally found me in Harlem. And they wouldn't let her in. At that point, my parents had done the same ritual and found me. They wouldn't let her in. They said, Mr. and Mrs. Kirkland don't want anybody to see her. And so she climbed the fire escape in the middle of the night and was very charming, talked the intern into letting her go into my room, at which point she screamed at me and yelled at me, how can you do this? I love you. People love you. We all love you. The next morning, I opened my eyes and there were all these people in white. And I thought, oh my God, this is great. I made it. I'm in heaven, St. Peter's Gate. Everybody's in white. I'm in heaven. And then I looked up and I saw tubes coming out of my throat for a tracheotomy, tubes coming out of my wrists, my ankles, blown up like a balloon. And they said to me, who is Betty? I couldn't talk because of the trach. I wrote on a pad they gave me. I said, she loved me more than anybody. And they said, well, you better be very grateful to Betty because that's why you're alive.
Actress Sally Kirkland. Another great guest on Filmmaking Confidential is legendary director Lloyd Kaufman.
The other countries, Canada and Europe, have a lot more open-mindedness. They encourage their independent filmmakers. You have free speech in the United States as long as you don't say anything.
You can hear my full interview with Lloyd at filmmakingconfidential.com or by subscribing for free to this podcast. When we come back, we'll find out how Sally started acting again thanks to her being the first nude actress on the American stage. And we'll hear stories about Andy Warhol, De Niro, Pacino, Dylan, and a hilarious night with Francis Ford Coppola. I'm Steve Balderson, and you're listening to the Filmmaking Confidential podcast. Stay with us. Here's a clip of Sally Kirkland in Anna.
The club, and he was drunk, and he stood up on a table and he lifted up his champagne and he said, checks are finished. And then he pulled down his pants and he pissed on the check flag on the table. I picked up the nearest ashtray, I smashed it on his head, and I broke his skull and nearly killed him.
The nominees for Best Performance by an Actress in a Motion Picture Drama are
Glenn Close, Fatal Attraction,
Faye Dunaway, Barfly,
Sally Kirkland, Anna,
Rachel Levin, Gabby, A True Story,
Barbara Streisand, Nuts,
and the winner is Sally Kirkland.
Now, back to our conversation.
I got a phone call from Tom O'Horgan, he directed Hair, and Ellen Stewart, La Mama, and they said, Sally, we want you to come be in the La Mama troupe. We hear that you, at the Actors Studio, were always nude, and we want to do a play, a lesbian play, where you would be nude. And I said, oh, God, that sounds great, because I was the first nude actress in American theater in the 60s before Hair. But my doctors tell me I can never act again because I'm emotionally unable to cope with my emotions, and so I can never act again. And they said, well, that's crazy. So I went to work for the La Mama Troupe and Tom O'Horgan and started doing plays like Tom Paine and Futz and Sam Shepard's play, Melodrama.
Warhol was the first person to put you on film.
Yeah, the first film of any note was Andy in 13 Most Beautiful Women, 1964. And he said, I'm going to push you on this chair and I don't want you to do anything. And I'm going to leave for 5 or 10 minutes. And I just want you to sit there. I don't want you to talk. I don't want you to move. So I, being a method actor, ironically, I just did for Reels TV. I just did a rather lengthy interview on Dennis Hopper that will air in a couple of months. And he said the same thing I said publicly. I'm a method actor. I'm not an underground Andy Warhol actor. So I'm going to cry on cue. And so I did an emotional recall and suddenly my eyes are watering up. I have this memory, I don't know whether it shows in the movie, of a tear running down my face. And I was so happy I could do that because he told me I couldn't move. He was very happy. Gerard Malanga, who worked very closely with him, wrote a poem to go along with the footage. Yeah, and for Andy, I did the first happening. Back then, they had be-ins and happenings, but I was the first happening. Mick Jagger was supposed to be there in person singing, "I Can't Get No Satisfaction." And I was to come out of a 8-foot-tall cake or something and do the twist. I had my eeny weeny bikini and I had baby oil all over my body and Ken Scott fake jewelry. And Gerard Malanga was the other coming out of the cake too. I remember we had to climb up these stairs inside the cake and come out on the deck of the cake and dance. And Andy was just going, he was so happy. It was his birthday. And that was the first happening.
And your mother, okay, so was she editor of Life before Vogue?
No. Vogue in the 40s and Life in the 50s and 60s. Yeah. Okay.
And you, who was it that she came to you and said, tell me about these people? And you said you should put them on the cover.
Well, a lot of people, Dylan, Presley, I think. They just didn't know. I mean, they didn't know what the kids knew. And so my mother came to me. They all knew me, the editors of Life, the senior editors of Life, which were mostly men. And my mother was one of two female senior editors. She said, we all have a question for you. We want you to come to the tower. The tower was the Time Life building. And it was, you went into the room and they had maybe 50 covers on the wall. And they were all the group of senior editors going to pick who was going to be on the cover. Mind you, my mother as fashion editor put Grace Kelly on and, Audrey Hepburn on and Jackie Kennedy many times on. But in this precise moment, they said, who are the mop heads? I said, you don't know who the mop heads are? And they said, no. I said, they're the Beatles and you have to put them on the cover or your kids will never talk to you again. So they took me by my word and they put them on the cover. And that was the magazine Beatles cover story.
You've always been known as a great actress.
Thank you.
Who have you worked with that stand out as far as a director that you worked with that you really, really loved working with?
Ron Howard. He, when I was at William Morris on the short list back in the late 80s, early 90s, they told me I was going to meet with Ron Howard for a film called Parenthood. They gave me the script. It was, if you saw it, it was the part that Diane Weiss did, and she has a vibrator and the whole thing. I memorized all lines, which is something that I did and still do before I go to meet somebody of that import. I knew all the lines. I was ready for anything. But William Mars told me, you don't have to audition. You're a Best Actress Oscar nominee. This is just a meeting. You're on the short list. There's you and two other people. And I said, really? Because all my life I've been auditioning. And I was trying to learn the ropes of being a short list, A-list actor. And I thought maybe this is what they all do. I don't know. So I went to the meeting. I sat there and I said, why me, Ron? Do you know my work? Did you see Anon? He said, no. He said, you crack me up. I'm an insomniac. And I watch you on the Joe Franklin show late at night, you know, 11 o'clock at night. I don't know if you know who Joe Franklin was, but in New York, he was a talk show host who would have people like me on and a lot of actors who loved to do talk shows but couldn't get on Johnny Carson. You know, he said, I have laughed so much at you. I think you are so funny. Will you please read for me? And I thought, oh, God, it was that awful moment. If I had to count on like five of the biggest mistakes I ever made in my life, this would be number one. I said, Ron, I will have a messenger within 40 minutes deliver you Anna. If you please watch Anna, it's 88 minutes, and you still want me to read, I will read. But I promise you that if you see Anna, I'm funny, I'm tragic, I'm everything. He said, oh, Sally, please read for me. And it was just, so I didn't do it. So he went to New York the next day, met with Diane Weist. She read and she got the part. So years later, he was doing that film in Ireland with Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman. He was approached about me to play the madam and go to Ireland and whatnot. And he sent me a message. He said, I think you're incredible, Sally, but they've told me I have to do an Irish actress. Like, you know, I have to with the union or whatnot. So that didn't happen. So 10 years from parenthood, I get a call from my then agent, Sharon Kemp. And she says, you have a meeting with Ron Howard for a film called Ed TV. And I said, I do? It's 10 years later, you know? And I said, oh my God. I remember it was pouring rain. I memorized all the lines of the script. This time I was going to be ready. And we went to wherever his offices were. And I said, Ron, I said, how long do I have with you? And he said, 45 minutes. I said, I have 45 minutes with you? And he said, yes. Are you kidding me? No. So we talked at first. We talked about Roger Corman, how we both got our start with Roger Corman. At that time, I was about to have my implants taken out. This is 1998 when I met you. And then it was time to audition. And like I said, I knew all of the lines. And I did the scenes, all of the scenes in the film of Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson's mother. At one point, Ron was under the table because he was laughing so hard he didn't want to disturb my audition. And that's when I knew I had it in the bag. You know, he just kept laughing and laughing and laughing at me. And she's taping me. He did spend the whole 45 minutes with me, getting to know me, the whole thing. I had never had a director do that, you know, spend 45 minutes with me. I mean, you spent hours with me at the Silver Spoon, but that didn't quite work out. Anyway, he walked me out into the rain where my car was, and he hugged me. I knew then that I had the role, even though he didn't tell me that. And then when I went on the set, I was so impressed that he took a week before the shoot to have his cameraman shoot improvs that we did, all of us, me, Woody, listen to this cast, Rob Reiner, Ellen from The Ellen Show, DeGeneres, Dennis Hopper played my ex-husband, Martin Landau was my husband, and of course, Matthew and Woody. And we all improvised. Even though the writers who had also written Parenthood, even though we didn't want to change anything, we loved our lines, but he still wanted us to do these improvs. And then he would have them on tape and he would stick little things in the movie that we had done. I was really impressed with that. And then during the shoot, it was the warmest, friendliest shoot I've ever been on. I think I've done, well, I don't know where... I certainly have done 200 movies and 50 television movies or whatnot. I never have I seen such a loving, friendly, warm set. And Woody would come in with, of course, Matthew and Woody would try and get me high on marijuana all the time. And I had given that up with Bob Dylan in 1976. My last joint was with Bob Dylan. But they came in with brownies, with whatnot, and all sorts of marijuana things. And I would always renege. And then Matthew would flirt with me, which made me crazy because I'm his mother. And he's so gorgeous. He's one of the most gorgeous people I've ever seen. And he's flirting with me. And I'm saying, stop that. I'm your mother. So I don't know. The experience was incredible. So Ron Howard goes down in my book as someone who loves actors, knows how to communicate with them, knows how to let them be free, and made us all look great. The foreign press wanted to give me a Golden Globe. But fucking Universal wouldn't send out 88 screeners to them. So that moment passed.
Here's what legendary director Roger Corman had to say about Sally.
Sally on set was very intense. She was so much into the character that she carried that character into her interaction with the crew, with the other actors, with other people. She was in that part psychologically all day long.
I remember that Mama Cass and Cher wanted to meet De Niro at one of my big Bel Air parties. And I had to explain to them that De Niro and Pacino hated Hollywood parties, that they only came to please me. But if they didn't mind coming out to the bushes with me, that's where they would be. And so I took Cher and Mama Cass out to the bushes. I think that particular party was in Laurel Canyon at Bobby Hart, who created the Monkees house. And they met, and that was how they met. So that was pretty funny. Another time at a party in Bel Air where 500 people were there, Bob Dylan came, sat down at the piano and played and sang. And then I sat down at the piano and I only knew three songs. But Bob said, "That's very good, Sally, very good." I was impressed that he liked it. And this famous English rock star sitting on the stairs singing, and Lainey Kazan was there singing. Everybody was singing. Joni Mitchell was there. And it's not so much that it was funny. It's just that you had to be there. Coppola was there. Back in the day at the Actors Studio, Al wanted to take me up. This is in 64. And I said, "Al, I only date tall men or men my height, 5'9", or over." And he said, "Oh, Sally, don't be silly. I'm going to be a big star." And I said, "I'm sure you are, but I only date taller men." So he remembered that. Jump cut years later, I'm teaching at the Lee Strasberg Theater Institute. 350 students are there. Al is on stage. And Al says, "You know, I was in love with your teacher back in 1964, but she wouldn't date me because you were too short. And you said to me that you were going to be the biggest star that ever was. And you were, Al." Anyway, so Al says, "Will you come to lunch with me and Francis Ford Coppola?" At that point, Godfather hadn't happened. And we're all at lunch. And I also know intuitively that he is going to direct my friend Al in The Godfather. But there were so many problems involved that I was the one that they called when Bob Evans was getting shit from the Paramount bosses about Al. And they said, "Is there anybody else?" And I said, "Yes, his name is Robert De Niro." So I got him his audition with Coppola back then. Coppola said, "Sally, I saw your film Coming Apart with Rip Torn. I think you're brilliant. I want you to be the lead actress in my repertory company in San Francisco." And I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. But I wanted him to say, "I want you to be in my movie," you know? So it's like maybe mistake number two. I didn't say all the things I was supposed to say when he said that to me. And jump cut, time goes by. And I see Al walking down Columbus Avenue in New York, and there's tears coming down his face. And I said, "Al, what's the matter? Come on, let's have coffee." And he said, "They don't want me. They don't want me." I said, "Al, Coppola's not going to do this film without you. You just have to grit your teeth and be patient." And he said, "I know, but I just can't. I can't anymore. I'm Sally. I'm tired. I'm exhausted. I'm emotionally drained. I'm rejected. I'm this, I'm that." And so anyway, I gave him a pep talk. And somewhere in that time frame, Coppola had Andrea Eastman call me. She was the casting director. And that's how Bobby went in there. And I said, "You know, Bobby's never going to take your part. He's just going to meet Coppola." Of course, he ended up being in Godfather 2. And Bobby ended up doing the Gun Couldn't Shoot Straight because Bobby knew that Al was going to get the Godfather. And so he was going to step in and take Al's part in the Gang That Couldn't Shoot Straight with my best friend, Lee Taylor Young. Anyway, Coppola called me and said, "Can I come to your house and bring you dinner?" And I said, "Sure." Now I was a yogi then. Coming Apart, I was about as sexy as I ever got in a movie, other than In the Heat of Passion for Corman. And everybody wanted to, fuck me because of this film, Coming Apart. So he thought he was going to meet Sally from Coming Apart. But I was in white pajamas at this point. I had become Satya, which is Hindu for truth. And I was teaching 10 classes a week at the Integral Yoga Institute for Swami Satchidananda. There was no furniture in my apartment. I lived in a sixth floor, $68 a month, water flat, with the bathtub in the kitchen and the toilet in the closet, and no stove, a board over the bathtub where there was a little hot burner. And I had a very thick rug that I could do my yoga asanas on, very thick. No furniture, just a thin piece of foam that I slept on, very thin piece of foam. So Coppola walks up with all of his girth, six flights of stairs. He gets there, he's got a large pizza and bottles of wine, and he comes in, Sally, and he looks around, and there's like no place to sit. He hugs me, and he looks at me, and I'm in my white pajamas. I said, oh, I'm so sorry, Francis. You know, I'm a yoga teacher and I don't have furniture. And maybe you can sit on the floor. Do you mind? On the piece of sponge? And he said, no, no, that's fine. And he said, I brought you all this food and drink. And I said, oh, please, Francis, don't forgive me. But I'm macrobiotic. I only eat brown rice. I'm fasting. I've been fasting for days. In fact, De Niro called me to find out how to fast for Bloody Mama. But I was fasting, and he looked so disappointed. Mind you, the book, The Godfather, had so many paperclips in it for Diane Keaton's role, which I was going to play in my mind. And this was the night. And my girlfriend had told me, Sally, you're going to have to fuck him. You're going to have to. This is the lead role in The Godfather. And I said, but I've been celibate for however many months. I can. I'm what's called a brahmacharya. Those are people who are studying to be a swami. I'm celibate. And she said, Sally, this is Francis Ford Coppola. You're going to have to fuck him. And I don't know whether that would have happened. That's what my girlfriend said. But behind the pillow, he pulled out the book of The Godfather with all of the paper clips. And he looked at me and he said, Sally, I'm so sorry. I can't cast you in this role. You're much too sexy. I'm in my white pajamas. You're much too sexy and earthy. I need a wasp. I said, I am a wasp. I was a debutante. I came out in 1959, Waldorf Astoria in New York. I'm in the Social Register in Philadelphia, New York. My grandparents were the mayor of Philadelphia and the judge of Philadelphia. I was horrified. And then after I absorbed that blow, I said, well, what about the other part? And he said, no, 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 no. And he gave me all the reasons why I wasn't right for that. Well, I was so disheartened. And he was probably disheartened too, because he expected the woman from Coming Apart. But he sat in a cross-legged position against the wall, and I sat in the lotus facing him. And we talked for about 4 hours. And then he was drinking the wine so much that he fell asleep. He had a aqua blue wool beanie on, and he fell asleep. And I sat lotus for all night and meditated and chanted. And the next morning he woke up and he looked at me, and there I was in the same position I was in when he laughed at me. And he said, oh, Sally, I'm so sorry. I took your bed. It was this thin piece of foam. And I said, no, 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 that's okay. I'm used to sitting in the lotus. Mind you, years later, I now have a titanium knee because I wrecked my knee with the lotus. And he kept apologizing. And I said, it's fine. I'm so honored that you were here. And I respect you so much. And I hope we're friends. And he took off his blue beanie and put it on my head and left.
Actress Sally Kirkland. You can learn more by visiting sallykirkland.com. Tune in next time for more Filmmaking Confidential. It is totally free to subscribe, and when you subscribe, you'll get upcoming new episodes automatically, and you'll have free access to all our past shows. Please remember to rate and review. The Filmmaking Confidential podcast is a production of Dakanga Audio and produced by myself and Ella Spencer. Our theme music is composed by Kevin Robles. For more of the Filmmaking Confidential podcast, head over to filmmakingconfidential.com. If you have a question about filmmaking you'd like answered on the podcast, send me an email using the contact form on the website. To learn more of my filmmaking secrets, be sure to pick up a copy of the book, Filmmaking Confidential, available on Audible, paperback, and ebook, wherever books are sold. I'm Steve Balderson. Thanks for listening and spreading the word. Until next time, keep making, keep doing, keep going.